Chapter 2 Interstellar Travel. While I was thus contemplating my native planet, I continued to soar through space. The Earth was visibly shrinking into the distance, and as I raced eastwards, it seemed to be rotating beneath me. All its features swung westwards, till presently sunset and the mid-Atlantic appeared upon its eastern limb, and then the night. Within a few minutes, as it seemed to me, the planet had become an immense half-moon. Soon it was a misty, dwindling crescent, beside the sharp and minute crescent of its satellite. With amazement I realized that I must be travelling at a fantastic, a quite impossible rate. So rapid was my progress that I seemed to be passing through a constant hail of meteors. They were invisible till they were almost abreast of me, for they shone only by reflected sunlight, appearing for an instant only as streaks of light, like lamps seen from an express train. Many of them I met in head-on collision, but they made no impression on me. One huge irregular bulk of rock, the size of a house, thoroughly terrified me. The illuminated mass swelled before my gaze, displayed for a fraction of a second a rough and lumpy surface, and then engulfed me. Or rather, I inferred that it must have engulfed me. But so swift was my passage that I had no sooner seen it in the middle distance than I found myself already leaving it behind. Very soon the Earth was a mere star. I say soon, but my sense of the passage of time was now very confused. Minutes and hours, and perhaps even days, even weeks, were now indistinguishable. While I was still trying to collect myself, I found that I was already beyond the orbit of Mars, and rushing across the thoroughfare of the asteroids. Some of these tiny planets were now so near that they appeared as great stars streaming across the constellations. One or two revealed gibbous, then crescent forms before they faded behind me. Already Jupiter, far ahead of me, grew increasingly bright and shifted its position among the fixed stars. The great globe now appeared as a disk, which soon was larger than the shrinking sun. Its four major satellites were little pearls floating beside it. The planet's surface now appeared like streaky bacon by reason of its cloud zones. Clouds fogged its whole circumference. Now I drew abreast of it and passed it. Owing to the immense depth of its atmosphere, night and day merged into one another without assignable boundary. I noted here and there on its eastern and unilluminated hemisphere vague areas of ruddy light, which were perhaps the glow cast upwards through dense cloud by volcanic upheavals. In a few minutes, or perhaps years, Jupiter had become once more a star, and then was lost in the splendour of the diminished but still blazing sun. No other of the outer planets lay near my course, but I soon realized that I must be far beyond the limits of even Pluto's orbit. The sun was now merely the brightest of the stars, fading behind me. At last, I had time for distress. Nothing now was visible but the starry sky. The Plough, Cassiopeia, Orion, the Pleiades, mocked me with their familiarity and their remoteness. The sun was now but one among the other bright stars. Nothing changed. Was I doomed to hang thus forever out in space? A bodiless viewpoint? Had I died? Was this my punishment for a singularly ineffectual life? Was this the penalty of an inveterate will to remain detached from human affairs and passions and prejudices? In imagination, I struggled back to my suburban hilltop. I saw our home. The door opened. A figure came out into the garden, lit by the hall light. She stood for a moment, looking up and down the road, then went back into the house. But all this was imagination only. In actuality, there was nothing but the stars. After a while, I noticed that the sun and all the stars in his neighborhood were ruddy. Those of the opposite pole of the heaven were of an icy blue. The explanation of this strange phenomenon flashed upon me. I was still traveling, and traveling so fast that light itself was not wholly indifferent to my passage. The overtaking undulations took long to catch me. They therefore affected me as slower pulsations than they normally were, and I saw them therefore as red. Those that met me on my headlong flight were congested and shortened, and were seen as blue. Very soon the heavens presented an extraordinary appearance, for all the stars directly behind me were now deep red, while those directly ahead were violet. Rubies lay behind me, amethysts ahead of me. Surrounding the ruby constellations, there spread an aura of topaz stars, and round the amethyst constellations, an area of sapphires. Beside my course, on every side, the colours faded into the normal white of the sky's familiar diamonds. Since I was travelling almost in the plane of the galaxy, the hoop of the Milky Way, white on either hand, was violet ahead of me, red behind. Presently, the stars immediately before and behind grew dim, then vanished, leaving two starless holes in the heaven, each hole surrounded by a zone of coloured stars. Evidently, I was still gathering speed. Light from the forward and the hinder stars now reached me in forms beyond the range of my human vision. As my speed increased, the two starless patches, before and behind, each with its coloured fringe, continued to encroach upon the intervening zone of normal stars which lay abreast of me on every side. Among these I now detected movement. Through the effect of my own passage, the nearer stars appeared to drift across the background of the stars at greater distance. This drifting accelerated, till for an instant the whole visible sky was streaked with flying stars. Then everything vanished. Presumably my speed was so great in relation to the stars that light from none of them could take normal effect on me. Though I was now perhaps travelling faster than light itself, I seemed to be floating at the bottom of a deep and stagnant well. The featureless darkness, the complete lack of all sensation, terrified me. If I may call terror, the repugnance and foreboding which I now experienced, without any of the bodily accompaniments of terror, without any sensation of trembling, sweating, gasping, or palpitation. Forlornly and with self-pity, I longed for home, longed to see once more the face that I knew best. With the mind's eye I could see her now, sitting by the fire sewing, a little furrow of anxiety between her brows. Was my body, I wondered, lying dead on the heather? Would they find it there in the morning? How would she confront this great change in her life? Certainly with a brave face, but she would suffer. But even while I was desperately rebelling against the dissolution of our treasured atom of community, I was aware that something within me, the essential spirit within me, willed very emphatically not to retreat, but to press on with this amazing voyage. Not that my longing for the familiar human world could for a moment be counterbalanced by the mere craving for adventure. I was of too homekeeping a kind to seek serious danger and discomfort for their own sake. But timidity was overcome by a sense of the opportunity that fate was giving me, not only to explore the depths of the physical universe, but to discover what part life and mind were actually playing among the stars. A keen hunger now took possession of me, a hunger not for adventure, but for insight into the significance of man, or of any man-like beings in the cosmos. This homely treasure of ours, this frank and spring-making daisy beside the arid track of modern life, impelled me to accept gladly my strange adventure. For might I not discover that the whole universe was no mere place of dust and ashes, with here and there a stunted life, but actually, beyond the parched terrestrial wasteland, a world of flowers? Was man indeed, as he sometimes desired to be, the growing point of the cosmical spirit, in its temporal aspect at least? Or was he one of many million growing points? Or was mankind of no more importance in the universal view than rats in a cathedral? And again, was man's true function power, or wisdom, or love, or worship, or all of these? Or was the idea of function, of purpose, meaningless in relation to the cosmos? These grave questions I would answer. Also, I must learn to see a little more clearly and confront a little more rightly, so I put it to myself, that which, when we glimpse it at all, compels our worship. I now seemed to my self-important self to be no isolated individual craving aggrandizement, but rather an emissary of mankind, no, an organ of exploration, a feeler projected by the living human world to make contact with its fellows in space. At all cost I must go forward, even if my trivial earthly life must come to an untimely end, and my wife and children be left without me. I must go forward, and somehow, someday, even if after centuries of interstellar travel, I must return. When I look back on that phase of exaltation, now that I have indeed returned to Earth after the most bewildering adventures, I am dismayed at the contrast between the spiritual treasure which I aspired to hand over to my fellow men and the paucity of my actual tribute. This failure was perhaps due to the fact that though I did indeed accept the challenge of the adventure, I accepted it only with secret reservations. Fear and the longing for comfort, I now recognize, dimmed the brightness of my will. My resolution, so boldly formed, proved, after all, frail. My unsteady courage often gave place to yearnings for my native planet. Over and over again in the course of my travels, I had a sense that, owing to my timid and pedestrian nature, I missed the most significant aspects of events. Of all that I experienced on my travels, only a fraction was clearly intelligible to me, even at the time. And then, as I shall tell, my native powers were aided by beings of superhuman development. Now that I am once more on my native planet, and this aid is no longer available, I cannot recapture even so much of the deeper insight as I formerly attained. And so my record, which tells of the most far-reaching of all human explorations, turns out to be, after all, no more reliable than the rigmarole of any mind unhinged by the impact of experience beyond its comprehension. To return to my story. How long I spent in debate with myself, I do not know. But soon after I had made my decision, the absolute darkness was pierced once more by the stars. I was apparently at rest, for stars were visible in every direction, and their color was normal. But a mysterious change had come over me. I soon discovered that by merely willing to approach a star, I could set myself in motion towards it, and at such a speed that I must have travelled much faster than normal light. This, as I knew very well, was physically impossible. Scientists had assured me that motion faster than the speed of light was meaningless. I inferred that my motion must therefore be in some manner a mental, not a physical phenomenon, that I was enabled to take up successive viewpoints without physical means of locomotion. It seemed to me evident, too, that the light with which the stars were now revealed to me was not normal, physical light. For I noticed that my new and expeditious means of travel took no effect upon the visible colors of the stars. However fast I moved, they retained their diamond hues, though all was somewhat brighter and more tinted than in normal vision. No sooner had I made sure of my new power of locomotion than I began feverishly to use it. I told myself that I was embarking on a voyage of astronomical and metaphysical research. But already my craving for the Earth was distorting my purpose. It turned my attention unduly towards the search for planets, and especially for planets of the terrestrial type. At random I directed my course towards one of the brighter of the near stars. So rapid was my advance that certain lesser and still nearer luminaries streamed past me like meteors. I swung close to the great sun, insensitive to its heat. On its mottled surface, in spite of the pervading brilliance, I could see with my miraculous vision a group of huge, dark sunspots, each one a pit into which a dozen Earths could have been dropped. Round the star's limb, the excrescences of the chromosphere looked like fiery trees and plumes and prehistoric monsters, a tiptoe or awing, all on a globe too small for them. Beyond these, the pale corona spread its films into the darkness. As I rounded the star in hyperbolic flight, I searched anxiously for planets, but found none. I searched again meticulously, tacking and veering near and far. In the wider orbits, a small object like the Earth might easily be overlooked. I found nothing but meteors, and a few insubstantial comets. This was the more disappointing because the star seemed to be of much the same type as the familiar Sun. Secretly, I had hoped to discover not merely planets, but actually the Earth. Once more I struck out into the ocean of space, heading for another near star. Once more I was disappointed. I approached yet another lonely furnace. This too was unattended by the minute grains that harbour life. I now hurried from star to star, a lost dog looking for its master. I rushed hither and thither, intent on finding a sun with planets, and among those planets, my home. Star after star I searched, but far more I passed impatiently, recognizing at once that they were too large and tenuous and young to be Earth's luminary. Some were vague ruddy giants broader than the orbit of Jupiter. Some smaller and more definite, had the brilliance of a thousand suns, and their color was blue. I had been told that our sun was of average type, but I now discovered many more of the great youngsters than of the shrunken, yellowish middle-aged. Seemingly, I must have strayed into a region of late stellar condensation. I noticed, but only to avoid them, great clouds of dust, huge as constellations, eclipsing the star streams, and tracts of palely glowing gas, shining sometimes by their own light, sometimes by the reflected light of stars. Often these nacreous cloud continents had secreted within them a number of vague pearls of light, the embryos of future stars. I glanced heedlessly at many star couples, trios, and quartets, in which more or less equal partners waltz in close union. Once, and once only, I came on one of those rare couples in which one partner is no bigger than a mere Earth, but massive as a whole great star and very brilliant. Up and down this region of the galaxy, I found here and there a dying star, somberly smouldering, and here and there the encrusted and extinguished dead. These I could not see till I was almost upon them, and then only dimly, by the reflected light of the whole heaven. I never approached nearer to them than I could help, for they were of no interest to me in my crazy yearning for the Earth. Moreover, they struck a chill into my mind, prophesying the universal death. I was comforted, however, to find that as yet there were so few of them. I found no planets. I knew well that the birth of planets was due to the close approach of two or more stars, and that such accidents must be very uncommon. I reminded myself that stars with planets must be as rare in the galaxy as gems among the grains of sand on the seashore. What chance had I of coming upon one? I began to lose heart. The appalling desert of darkness and barren fire, the huge emptiness so sparsely pricked with scintillations, the colossal futility of the whole universe, hideously oppressed me. And now, an added distress, my power of locomotion began to fail. Only with a great effort could I move at all among the stars, and then but slowly and ever more slowly. Soon I should find myself pinned fast in space, like a fly in a collection, but lonely, eternally alone. Yes, surely this was my special hell. I pulled myself together. I reminded myself that even if this was to be my fate, it was no great matter. The Earth could very well do without me. And even if there was no other living world anywhere in the cosmos, still the Earth itself had life, and might wake to far fuller life. And even though I had lost my native planet, still that beloved world was real. Besides, my whole adventure was a miracle. And by continued miracle, might I not stumble on some other earth? I remembered that I had undertaken a high pilgrimage, and that I was man's emissary to the stars. With returning courage, my power of locomotion returned. Evidently it depended on a vigorous and self-detached mentality. My recent mood of self-pity and earthward yearning had hampered it. Resolving to explore a new region of the galaxy, where perhaps there would be more of the older stars and a greater hope of planets, I headed in the direction of a remote and populous cluster. From the faintness of the individual members of this vaguely speckled ball of light, I guessed that it must be very far afield. On and on I travelled in the darkness. As I never turned aside to search, my course through the ocean of space never took me near enough to any star to reveal it as a disk. The lights of heaven streamed remotely past me, like the lights of distant ships. After a voyage during which I lost all measure of time, I found myself in a great desert, empty of stars, a gap between two star streams, a cleft in the galaxy. The Milky Way surrounded me, and in all directions lay the normal dust of distant stars. But there were no considerable lights, save the thistledown of the remote cluster which was my goal. This unfamiliar sky disturbed me with a sense of my increasing dissociation from my home. It was almost a comfort to note, beyond the furthest stars of our galaxy, the minute smudges that were alien galaxies, incomparably more distant than the deepest recesses of the Milky Way, and to be reminded that in spite of all my headlong and miraculous travelling, I was still within my native galaxy, within the same little cell of the cosmos, where she, my life's friend, still lived. I was surprised, by the way, that so many of the alien galaxies appeared to the naked eye, and that the largest was a pale, cloudy mark bigger than the moon in the terrestrial sky. By contrast with the remote galaxies, on whose appearance all my voyaging failed to make impression, the star cluster ahead of me was now visibly expanding. Soon after I had crossed the great emptiness between the star streams, my cluster confronted me as a huge cloud of brilliance. Presently, I was passing through a more populous area, and then the cluster itself opened out ahead of me, covering the whole forward sky with its congested lights. As a ship approaching port encounters other craft, so I came upon and passed star after star. When I had penetrated into the heart of the cluster, I was in a region far more populous than any that I had explored. On every side the sky blazed with suns, many of which appeared far brighter than Venus in the Earth's sky. I felt the exhilaration of a traveller who, after an ocean crossing, enters harbour by night and finds himself surrounded by the lights of a metropolis. In this congested region, I told myself, many close approaches must have occurred, many planetary systems must have been formed. Once more I looked for middle-aged stars of the sun's type. All that I had passed hitherto were young giants great as the whole solar system. After further searching, I found a few likely stars, but none had planets. I found also many double and triple stars, describing their incalculable orbits, and great continents of gas in which new stars were condensing. At last, I found a planetary system. With almost insupportable hope, I circled among these worlds. But all were greater than Jupiter, and all were molten. Again, I hurried from star to star. I must have visited thousands, but all in vain. Sick and lonely, I fled out of the cluster. It dwindled behind me into a ball of down, sparkling with dewdrops. In front of me, a great tract of darkness blotted out a section of the Milky Way and the neighbouring area of stars, save for a few near lights which lay between me and the obscuring opacity. The billowy edges of this huge cloud of gas or dust were revealed by the glancing rays of bright stars beyond it. The sight moved me with self-pity. On so many nights at home had I seen the edges of dark clouds silvered just so by moonlight. But the cloud which now opposed me could have swallowed not merely whole worlds, not merely countless planetary systems, but whole constellations. Once more my courage failed me. Miserably I tried to shut out the immensities by closing my eyes. But I had neither eyes nor eyelids. I was a disembodied, wandering viewpoint. I tried to conjure up the little interior of my home, with the curtains drawn and the fire dancing. I tried to persuade myself that all this horror of darkness and distance and barren incandescence was a dream, that I was dozing by the fire, that at any moment I might wake, that she would reach over from her sewing and touch me and smile. But the stars still held me prisoner. Again, though with failing strength, I set about my search. And after I had wandered from star to star for a period that might have been days or years or eons, luck or some guardian spirit directed me to a certain sun-like star. And looking outwards from this center, I caught sight of a little point of light, moving with my movement against the patterned sky. As I leapt towards it, I saw another and another. It was indeed a planetary system much like my own. So obsessed was I with human standards that I sought out at once the most earth-like of these worlds. And amazingly earth-like it appeared, as its disk swelled before me or below me. Its atmosphere was evidently less dense than ours, for the outlines of unfamiliar continents and oceans were very plainly visible. As on the earth, the dark sea brilliantly reflected the sun's image. White cloud tracts lay here and there over the seas and the lands, which, as on my own planet, were mottled green and brown. But even from this height, I saw that the greens were more vivid and far more blue than terrestrial vegetation. I noted also that on this planet there was less ocean than land, and that the centers of the great continents were chiefly occupied by dazzling, creamy white deserts.